It was a dark and stormy night. Okay, not really. I mean, it's dark. Most nights are, but it's not exactly stormy. Although, looking at the radar, it might actually do that, but you didn't come here for a weather report, and I'm certainly not qualified to give you one. I am somewhat qualified to talk about the saint that we celebrated today, and I promised a short reflection on his life earlier, so here you go. Here's a couple thoughts on Saint Cyril of Jerusalem, bishop and doctor of the church. I feel like Saint Cyril is one of those saints that's probably a little bit overlooked, even though he is a doctor of the church, and there's only, what, like 20-some doctors of the church. We should probably have a better sense and understanding of who they are, and if this thing stretches out much longer, maybe I'll start doing, like, just little sections on each doctor individually. That could be kind of fun. But anyway, Cyril is a bishop and doctor of the church, as I said. He's one of the early church fathers. He's from the period around the Council of Nicaea, so he's one of the Nicene fathers. And I think that's why he sometimes flies under the radar, because he's kind of overshadowed by some of the really big names of the Nicene fathers, saints like Athanasius, St. Basil the Great, St. Gregory of Nyssa, St. Gregory of Nazianzus, St. Ambrose, all of whom are also doctors of the church. And they all have substantially more writings that remain than what Cyril did. That's actually kind of what makes Cyril cool. I'll get to that in a second. So Cyril was the bishop of Jerusalem for approximately 40 years, but it wasn't a good 40 years. Of those 40 years, he probably spent about 20 of them in exile. He was exiled from his own diocese at three different points. And this poor guy, for most of his time as a bishop, he was always being viewed with suspicion. And the suspicion started because of the bishop who ordained him a bishop. That bishop was known to be very sympathetic to the Arian heresy. And so a lot of Orthodox bishops that didn't know Cyril and just knew of him by reputation assumed that he was also an Arian. Now, not true at all. Cyril's actually very, very Orthodox to church teachings. But they just knew the reputation, and so they assumed that he wasn't as good. Meanwhile, in Jerusalem, a lot of the people there are very sympathetic to the Arian side of things. And so they look at Cyril with a great deal of suspicion because he's not teaching what they want to hear. He's teaching the truth. And so a lot of times they're the ones that force him into exile. At one point, he doesn't help his own cause, because when he gets to the Council of Nicaea, Cyril is at his heart a teacher, and he just wants to be able to teach accurately and well. And so he asks a question about the statement, one in being with the Father, or consubstantial with the Father, as we say now in the Creed. And all he wanted was a clarification, but what they heard was, he's an Arian, or he's an Arianist, because he's asking whether or not Jesus is really of the same substance as the Father. He's denying that. He must be a heretic. We have to get rid of him. Not at all what his intention was. He just wanted to be precise with language, but people will hear what they want to hear. I guess in some ways the church hasn't changed at all, but that's a whole other rant. It got to the point, actually, where some other bishops throughout the world decided to send St. Gregory of Nyssa to Jerusalem to investigate Cyril and to make sure that his teachings were, in fact, accurate and orthodox and everything else. And Gregory comes back. They actually become really great friends during this whole thing. And Gregory comes back to the other bishops and says to them, listen, Jerusalem is a mess in many ways. The moral life of the people isn't great, and politically it's a nightmare, and Cyril has his work cut out for him, but you're not going to find a more orthodox bishop. He's not the problem. There are plenty of problems, but the bishop's not one of them. And so with Gregory kind of at his side, when Cyril gets to the Council of Constantinople, he's kind of given a chance to start teaching and to kind of guide some of the discussion there. And the rest of the bishops finally realize, well, this guy was all right. This guy was, in fact, really, really good this whole time. And we doubted him, and we kind of were pushing him off to the side, and we probably shouldn't have done that. So Cyril's greatest teachings, though, aren't what happened at the Council of Constantinople. They're teachings that he gave while he was in Jerusalem at one of the points when he wasn't exiled. And the teaching that he was especially, or the people that he was especially gearing his teachings to, were those that were going to be coming into the church for the first time. And he wanted them to be well-versed in just everything that the church taught about all kinds of different things, and then he wanted to teach them even after they came into the church. So if you're familiar with the RCIA process now, you know that after the Easter Vigil, when people actually enter into the church either to come into full communion and make their first communion and confirmation, or to come all the way in and be baptized even and receive everything, after the Easter Vigil, they're supposed to enter into a period called mystagogy. And mystagogy is one of those things where there's like a continuing catechesis, because they certainly couldn't have learned everything they needed to learn during the RCIA, but also to kind of unpack some of the things that just happened. I mean, they just received this tremendous spiritual gift, and you can't, like, it takes a while for that to process. Kind of, as an example, it's not the same thing, but it's close. And those of you that have known me for a really long time might remember this. I was ordained a priest in 2014, and I spent 10 weeks at a parish being a priest, and I loved it. But at the end of that time, I was supposed to go back to Rome for one more year of school so that I could finish my my license degree, write my thesis and all that kinds of stuff. And I was not at all excited about doing that. I wanted to stay, and I wanted to do the work that I had been ordained to do. And a priest friend of mine who had been in that same situation about 10 years before said to me that it's actually not the worst thing in the world to have to go back to Rome and do all this extra work, because he said it gives you a chance for your psychology to catch up to your ontology. Meaning the ontological change of ordination was immediate. It happened right there at the actual ordination mass. But unpacking the reality of being a priest is something that takes a while. And you have to have a little bit of time and a little bit of space to be able to do that. And so being in the heart of the church and concentrating on studies, that was a great way to do that. Well, I think it's certainly the same thing with the Easter Vigil. There's an immediate ontological change when a person is baptized or when a person is confirmed. But it might take their psychology a while for that really to become a reality, for that reality to resonate with them. Like, what does this mean now that I've been redeemed by the blood of the Lamb? What does it mean now that I've been grafted onto this great vine? What does it mean that I'm God's chosen son or daughter, you know? And I don't know that we give people a chance necessarily to do that. I don't know how well even those of us that maybe have been, you know, basically born into the church and been Catholics our whole life, I don't know how often we give ourselves a chance to think about this. And one of the things that Cyril said, I love this quote, when he's talking to the people coming into the church, he says to them, "Already you stand on the frontier of mystery." Meaning that their life in the church is almost always going to have this great element of mystery to it, that we're constantly trying to unpack what this means. And what does it mean to be a member of the church? And what does it mean to belong to Jesus Christ? And how does that inform everything we do? And when you think about it, your life is full of change, and the person you are today is not the person that you were, hell, even a week ago, but I mean, certainly 6 months, 6 years, whatever. Like a lot has changed about you, and the one thing that's constant is Christ, but how does your relationship with Him inform all of those other things that are happening in your life? Life is a mystery, and we need to have some space to think about that mystery or just the messiness of our life in terms of Jesus Christ. So I think we all kind of need a period of mystagogy, but that's beside the thing. So Cyril gives this series of lectures on, it's called the catechetical mystagogy. That's what the kind of the whole thing is called, but it's more than just about mystagogy. It was even lectures before they were brought into the church, and he did all of them without notes. He would just get up and start speaking extemporaneously. And the only way we have any record of it is that there were stenographers in the crowd who were trying to capture everything he said, which was pretty common in that time and that place. You see it a lot, too, with Ambrose and Augustine. people just writing down what he said, but he got up there and gave these talks without notes. And Pope Benedict XVI would refer to Cyril's speeches as being almost symphonic in the way that he could take the scriptures from the Old Testament and from the New Testament and seamlessly weave them together until he arrived at how Christ is the center of whatever it is he was teaching that day, and then drill down really deeply into that mystery centered on Christ and teach whatever that point of doctrine was. So he has a series of lectures that are more just preparatory, and then he gets this long but a really good series on the Eucharist itself, because it's the source, the summit of the Christian life. And then he goes into like this mystagogical series of lectures, which are mainly more practical than anything else, just like, how do you live out this reality? But they've also got some kind of good spiritual reflections in them as well. The one I want to share with you tonight, I just want to read this one little piece. It's from a lecture he gave on confession. And it's just, I think it's a good thing to consider during Lent, because that's what he's talking about. He starts by saying, now Lent is the season of confession. But I think he's saying this to the people that are particularly hesitant to go to the sacrament of reconciliation. And I know a lot of people often are, because there's a sense of shame or embarrassment or whatever it is. But he would call you out on that. So here's what he says. Where was it? Blot out from your mind all earthly care, for you are running for your soul. You are utterly forsaking the things of the world. Small are the things you are forsaking. Great what the Lord is giving. Forsake things present, and put your trust in things to come. Have you run so many circles of the years, bustling vainly about the world, and have you not 40 days to be free for prayer and your own soul's sake? Be still and know that I am God, says the Scripture. Excuse yourself from speaking many idle words. Neither backbite nor lend a willing ear to backbiters, but rather be prompt to prayer. Show an ascetic exercise that your heart is strengthened. Cleanse your vessel that you may receive grace more abundantly. For the remission of sins is given equally to all. The communion of the Holy Spirit is bestowed in proportion to each man's faith. If you have labored little, you receive little. But if you have worked much, the reward is great. You are running for your soul. See to your own interest. So Cyril would just, he has no time for people that are too embarrassed to go to confession. That's not an excuse. That's not anything. It's just dumb. You know, the reward is too great and the risk is too high. Go to confession, he would say, and prepare your soul for everything that you're about to receive. You stand on the frontier of mystery. Don't miss what that mystery is, because it's the most beautiful thing that you're ever going to discover. All right, I think that's about all for now. Tomorrow is a huge feast day, a great feast day for the church, the Solemnity of St. Joseph, the husband of Mary. So I'm going to try to come up with some really good content for that. We'll see how that goes. Remember to wash your hands, say your prayers, and God bless.